Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Listeners do support the Peter B. Collins Show in so many ways, and I'm grateful. The latest arrival is a stuffed bee. Yeah, you know, yellow with black stripes. He's currently riding on my microphone boom, monitoring the program. And that's a gift from Ann Heyman in Lynn Haven, Florida, a new listener to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thank you very much. On a recent program, we talked with journalist Reese Ehrlich about the trip that he and Norman Solomon took to Afghanistan in August. And Reese is the co-author of a piece that has just been published online by Vanity Fair magazine at vanityfair.com about an incident that occurred in Syria just about 1 year ago as we speak. The co-author of the piece with Reese Ehrlich is actor and writer Peter Coyote, who joins us on the program today. He's appeared in more than 130 films, and his books include Sleeping Where I Fall and the forthcoming Lies We Like to Believe. Peter Coyote, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter.
So you traveled to Syria with Reese, and I know he has been to that part of the world many times. He's reported to us on his multiple trips to Iran, Iraq, and Afghanistan. What's your experience in the region?
Well, it was my first experience in the region, and I was glad to be with a guy as seasoned and canny as Reese. Reese actually looks like all the Middle Easterners, and when people would dimly recognize me from the television or film, they would usually go up to Reese and ask him in Arabic who the guy with him was.
And is Reese fluent?
No, he doesn't speak a word. But I bought him a hat, a kind of little flat cap that the Arab men wear.
Uh-huh.
And he fit in so well that when the call to the mosque came, people looked askance at him because he wasn't heading toward the prayers.
Oh, yeah. And in Syria, are the speakers that they use to play that music that announces the prayers, are they any better than they are in other parts of the Muslim world?
No, I wouldn't say they are.
That's the one thing that I have noticed about the call to prayer. I mean, it's a fascinating and important ritual, but I just wish they'd get better speakers.
Well, it's true. I don't understand. You know, a lot of these are little neighborhood churches. When I was in Fez this summer in Morocco, on top of my hotel on the roof, I would go up at night and I would listen to the call to prayer move across the entire valley.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like one little neighborhood church after another. So they don't have the material wealth, you know, to be buying Meyer sound speakers and preamps and what have you. I think they do the best they can.
Yeah. Well, you traveled to Syria, and you hired a car and driver. You got permission from the director of something or other. And
yeah, the Minister of the Interior, in effect,
uh-huh.
Because we, first of all, there were some journalists that tried to go there, and they were arrested.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want that. Second of all, we wanted to sort of touch base and test the water, make sure we weren't going to disappear or, I don't know, be on a YouTube video. And so we did that, and we got permission, and it was generous permission. We were left alone.
Mm-hmm.
We hired our own driver. We went there. We had no minders. We had no followers. And I think that's because the Syrians wanted the story told.
And your destination was a farm near a town called Al-Sukariya. Tell us what happened there just about a year ago.
Well, on October 26th, four helicopters full of U.S. troops, probably Special Forces or Delta Forces, flew into this farm. And in that part of the country, a farm is basically an area about the size of half a football field. And it's bounded by a cinder block wall, usually about 10 to 12 feet high. And it has a door at each end, and they'll usually build a little house, and they'll have a little olive orchard or some kind of fruit tree orchard in there.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, this farm simply had a Bedouin tent where the night watchman and his wife and six-year-old son guarded the timber and concrete. And there was a ditch at one end with a little concrete poured and some rebar sticking out of it. And this must have looked pretty suspicious on overhead surveillance, because these four helicopters came in, and they came in hot, firing out of the door guns, and two went to one side, one went to the base near the Euphrates River, and one landed inside. And there were seven men working in there, and they killed them all. And there was a woman huddling in the tent. His name was Suad, and she was the wife of the night watchman,
mm-hmm.
and her six-year-old son. And a soldier came in and made a motion with his hand for her to sit still. And, you know, he came in, he had packs and gears and weapons, and the boy flipped out and ran outside. And his mother instinctively ran to get him, and the soldier shot her. So the mother passed out. She was grievously wounded. And this little six-year-old boy was left standing in the middle of this carnage, where his neighbor and four sons and his father and a friend of his father's have all been gunned down.
And the account you just gave us is based on eyewitness commentary from Akran Hamid, who is a mechanic who happened to be fishing nearby.
Yes, and he was one. And from the woman herself, Suad, who was mm-hmm. shot, and from the son.
Mm-hmm.
And we also interviewed the head of the emergency room, the head of the morgue, and the head of the hospital.
Now, this raid did not get very much attention in the corporate media here in the United States, and it occurred just before the November election that all eyes were focused on, as Obama did defeat McCain. It's important to note that Israel took advantage of our distraction as well. And it was on our election day that they launched their renewed assault on the Gaza Strip. So it's interesting the timing of this event. But what's most important is that the U.S. government says that they killed an al-Qaeda leader named Abu Ghadiyah, G-H-A-D-I-Y-A. And as you report in the article, the only problem with that is that the his own people reported that he was killed in 2006.
Yeah, that's true. And there's another problem with, in Arabic writing, all of these names are quite clear and distinct. But when you transliterate from Arabic to English, there are 10 ways to spell these names. So one of the things that our sources made clear to us was, you know, they don't know who this al-Ghadiyah was. But the al-Qaeda al-Ghadiyah had been reported killed in a rocket attack. And this might have been some local cigarette smuggler. It might have been a grudge that a neighbor had against these people. In any case, the intelligence goes to the U.S. forces. It then goes to Baghdad. It then goes to Washington. It then goes to the Special Forces. And it had to go to Washington because this was a cross-border incursion, which is an act of war. We're not at war with Syria. And as a matter of fact, in July, Condoleezza Rice had congratulated Syria on their efforts at stopping smugglers and people from going across the border. So there's a lot of speculation. We couldn't get any administration officials to really talk to us on the record. Some people think it was a shot across the bow from the neocons to the State Department. Other people think it was an attempt at an October surprise to influence the election toward McCain.
Hmm.
But recently I went there because nearly every time that a major terrorist had been captured, There were trophy photographs. There were cell phones. There were various kinds of proof. And in this case, there was none. There were no named sources. It was very low-keyed. Many of the stories were datelined Washington. And we just didn't believe it.
And Peter Coyote, as you talked with the eyewitnesses, they were convinced that this was an American security force of some sort. Is there any confusion? Is there any even denial by our government that it was some arm of the U.S. government that conducted this covert raid?
No, there is no denial. As a matter of fact, unnamed sources have said, yes, we did. We took out a terrorist. We spoke to one CIA fellow who said, oh, yes, this was a Jim Croce moment. You know, we wanted to teach these guys not to tug on Superman's cape and not to pull the mask off the Lone Ranger.
Well, if you'll allow me, can we go to the original?
Yeah. Go down the country house, and when the bad folks all get together at night, you know they all call Big Jim Ball just because. You don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't spit into the wind. You don't pull a mask off an old Lone Ranger. And you don't mess around with Jim.
And just a footnote, I was a young DJ in Chicago, and I got to interview Jim Croce just a week before that plane went down.
Uh-huh.
So I was glad to dig that out of the Peter B. Collins tax-deductible music archives.
Well, that's great.
Just to add a little accent here. But this is important because I have another little cruder phrase for it, Peter Coyote, and that is that Cheney, in his embrace of what he called the dark side, and guiding us into torture and into an unnecessary war, all of these things seem to add up to what I call the crazy mofo theory, that Cheney and Bush decided on a strategy that they thought the only way to counter extremist Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, whom they clearly don't understand very well, was to be a crazier motherfucker and to just try to project the idea that we would go anywhere, snatch anybody, brutally kill them, that we would get down to the level of barbarism that we attribute to our enemy. And this seems to be an example of that kind of cowboy militarism.
Well, it's definitely cowboy militarism. I can't speculate on exactly what their motivation was. We know that oil was supposed to have a lot to do with it, and that was the first building they guarded when they got to Iraq, and they considered it more important than even the radioactive waste dumps. I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but I do know that what they said happened didn't happen. We spoke to another CIA guy named Bob Baer, who's was the man who the movie Syriana was based on,
mm-hmm.
And he just said, you know, it was garbage. If they had captured a terrorist, there would have been photographs. It was just they're covering up an error. And, you know, this was not much reported in the American press, but it was a huge deal in the Arab world. So the Arab world saw this. They got the message quite clearly. And they are wondering, what is American foreign policy going to be? Are we going to be in the gunfights anytime we don't please them? Obama campaigned on the rule of law and diplomacy, but today he's sending unmanned drones into Pakistan that are piloted by kids sitting in a trailer in Nevada, and they're whopping the crap out of civilians, and they're fanning nationalism and resentment against us. And this is a direct continuation of this al-Sukriya policy with a different administration.
Peter, as you and Reese explore in this article, again, it's online at vanityfair.com, one of the interesting aspects here is the acquiescence of the Syrian government. And you reference in passing Israel's attack on a facility that could or could not have been a nuclear facility near the town of Deir al-Zour, which was back in 2007. And at the time, we covered that as best we could with a lot of alternative journalists, if you will, because there was an official blackout on the event, and Syria itself seemed to be having a hard time knowing how to respond, and basically it was a very muted kind of one-day response from Syria. So tell me about that event and this one in terms of the lack of any definitive response from the Syrian government.
Well, we spoke to them about the plant that was bombed by the Israelis, and the Israelis bombed it, and they also had 3 days to muck around on the site, and they claimed they found a tiny, tiny amount of something radioactive. The Syrians, of course, claimed that it was a military base, but it was not a nuclear facility at all.
Mm-hmm.
They were not going to tell us what it was. None of our business. They could be telling the truth. They could be lying. But I think that the, you know, things are expensive for the Syrians. In the latter case, they didn't want to queer the possibility of a relationship with Obama, who the Arab world was hoping would be a very different kettle of fish. They didn't want to make a big stink, and they certainly were not going to take America on and give it the excuse for a full-scale invasion. And I think probably that they felt that Israel existed under America's cover. I don't know why they didn't make a bigger response to Israel,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, it's a huge power in the Mideast, and they must have had a strategic reason to lay low. I know I'm more certain of the strategic reason for not responding to al-Sukariya, because it was a week before the election,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to muddy the waters. And in fact, Obama went to the Middle East, and he gave that speech that's given everybody cause for hope and kind of was a new introduction to the Arab world.
Well, I hope that your article will provoke a response from the U.S. government, an acknowledgement of responsibility, and at minimum, an apology to the families of those who were killed and to Syria for this incursion, which was not only illegal, but appears to have had no justification of any sort, given that the target was already dead, and the U.S. should have known that.
Well, I wouldn't hold your breath, Peter. I mean, you know, one of the things that I look at, I've been looking at Iran a lot. And of course, Reese was there, and he wrote a good book about it. We met a lot of Iranians in Lebanon. And we also actually had an hour private interview with Khalil Mishal, who's the head of Hamas. And in Lebanon, we had an hour's private interview with Ayatollah Fadlallah, who's the head of Hezbollah there. And when you hear their point of view, it actually, there's a logic. You know, these people are just not drooling terrorists. At one point, Reese and I told Khalil Mishal, who, you know, United States brands a terrorist, that we were Jews. And he laughed, and he pointed around the room to four of his advisors. He said, these guys are Jews.
Hmm.
He said, we don't have a problem with Jews. We have a problem with an imposed Jewish state. So I said to him at one point, well, listen, why don't you just recognize Israel? Why don't you? And he laughed, and he said, it sounds so fair, doesn't it? And I said, yes, it does. It's just recognition. He said, look, don't you understand that's the crux of the issue? He said, we used to live together in this area that's being called, it used to be called Palestine, and a major world power came in and gave the Jews hegemony over us. We're never going to say that's right. We can accept it. We can make a peace treaty with them. We can face facts on the ground. But what do you think Native Americans would say if you asked them to say that it was right for white people to come in and practice genocide and take their land? So all of a sudden, I realized it was a trick question.
Hmm.
It's a question that's used to stall debate, and I had never read or heard that anywhere. So the same with Iran. You know, we keep talking about Iran like it's a bunch of, you know, sand fleas over there. It's a great major power in the Middle East, and the United States has yet to articulate to the Iranians how we see their role in the Middle East. And we have yet to say that we will not invade. We will not make some kind of first strike. And then we treat them like children. While we're smoking cigarettes, we tell them not to smoke. So everyone knows the Israelis have over 100 nuclear weapons. We have thousands of them. And who are we to dictate that they can't run a nuclear power research facility? You know who started the Iranian nuclear power program?
The United States under the Shah.
Henry Kissinger. That's right. So there's just a whole bunch of duplicity and stuff that's not being told to the American people. I don't doubt that the Iranians are kicking up as much mischief as they can around the world, but we are not practicing diplomacy with them. I'll tell you that.
Pete, before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask if you had seen on the television news coverage over the last couple of days that Dick Cheney has been rattling his retired sabers pretty loudly. And there was this grotesque scene, a banquet in Washington honoring a right-wing think tank's 20th anniversary. And they trotted out Scooter Libby and gave him some award, the Strong and Silent Award, or they had a name for it. I can't recall it. And Rumsfeld was there and a lot of these guys. And it just struck me that if we only had the subpoenas, that this is the way to get them all in one place at one time.
Yeah, you know, I saw something. I didn't see that, but I saw something even scarier that I'm really still surprised has not been picked up by the blogosphere. Day before yesterday in the New York Times, there was an article about Obama considering his options and trying to decide on his strategies. And there were basically three quotes from high-level military commanders who were just about threatening mutiny. They were saying things like, well, there's a great deal of discontent among the troops. The lightning hasn't struck yet. I hope that we can forestall it. And using these metaphors of imminent explosions and that could only have meant that the army was considering some sort of mutiny or coup. And this has not been picked up anywhere. I haven't seen it on any of the major media. I haven't seen it on any of the blogs. And my blood ran cold when I read it.
Yeah. Well, I have not seen that myself, so I'll look for that one and make some noise about it. Well, Peter Coyote, thank you for joining us, and I really appreciate what you and Reese Ehrlich did on your visit to Syria and the subsequent article. Again, it is up on the website at vanityfair.com.
Thank you very much.
We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic, too. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com for a special introductory offer just for you. Frank Schaefer joins me next. His new book is called Patience with God, subtitled Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. And this question keeps lingering. What if?
If God had a name, what would it be, and would you call it to his face? If you were faced with him in all his glory, what would you ask if you had just one question?
Frank Schaefer was born into the evangelical movement here in the United States, also known as the religious right. His father was a pastor who was well known at the time. And Frank grew up with leading evangelicals at the dinner table for high tea there in Switzerland. And he parted ways in the year 2000, partly in response to the way George W. Bush's team unloaded on John McCain in that South Carolina primary. And his new book is called Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. And he has joined forces with our friends at velvetrevolution.us, that's their website, to try to stop domestic terror. And after you hear his comments, you'll understand why. Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
I want to also refer people to rawstory.com, where our friend Larissa Alexandrovna did a great interview with you that was published recently and provided me with some insight into your background. I've seen you on TV, and I've seen the comments that you've offered, but I didn't really have the depth going back to, as I said, you were born into this. And you've made the comment that there's a lot of nepotism in the evangelical world, and you embraced it at first and ultimately rejected it. But give our listeners a quick sketch of how you grew up around Christian fundamentalism.
Yeah, well, okay, let me just take a minute to say that this is kind of a thumbnail of this memoir that I wrote that Alexandra was reading called Crazy for God, How I Grew Up with One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, Live to Take All or Almost All of It Back, which has been out for a few years. I was born in Switzerland in 1952. I'm 57 years old, to a pastor by the name of Francis Schaeffer and my mother Edith Schaeffer, who a number of years later became very well known in the evangelical community. When I was a kid, I was growing up in an obscure little religious commune on the side of the Swiss Alps, catered mainly to English-speaking hitchhikers, backpackers, travelers through Europe who would stay, study the Bible, listen, ask questions, and it was essentially a fundamentalist commune with a twist in that the door was open to all kinds of people, and so when the beat poets hit or the hippie movement came along, we would get our share of travelers who were part of those movements. And so I was a very interesting childhood, albeit one where there was no real privacy in the house. Everybody lived there. My dad and mom were very authentic people. They were very strict Calvinist Presbyterians on the one hand, but on the other hand, very compassionate, had an open door to all kinds of people coming through. That was the environment I grew up in. And then in the late 1960s, my dad wrote a series of books, which made him very famous, not to the world, but to the evangelical subculture. Mm-hmm. And after that, we used to get a lot of religious leaders coming through, people like Billy Graham, you know, the Pat Robertsons of this world. Barbara Bush was a guest. My parents got to know Ronald Reagan, the Bush family. Gerald Ford's kids were actually studying at LaBrie when their dad became president when Nixon resigned. And so we were very connected to not just the religious right as it was emerging, but the Republican Party.
Frank, why Switzerland? It's not even in Orange County.
Well, hey, exactly. It was one of those fluky deals. In 1947, Dad went over to Europe as a completely unknown American Presbyterian missionary as part of an effort to work with young people in the bombed-out cities of Europe. The only reason he stayed in Switzerland was because the infrastructure had not been bombed there, because Switzerland was neutral in the war, so he could get to Milan or to Paris or to Berlin or various places by train from there and then do his work in those cities. And then he stayed and founded this mission called LaBrie Fellowship. And So, you know, fast forward to the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, and all of a sudden, you know, Francis Schaeffer, my family, myself as a young man, sort of nepotistic sidekick of my father, as so many evangelical families are wont to have, you know, Billy Graham's son following in his footsteps, Robert Schuller, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
We basically became known for our anti-abortion stand as part of a film book project that I helped produce called Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which featured my dad and Dr. C. Everett Koop, who soon became Ronald Reagan's Surgeon General. And that really was the beginning of what became known as the evangelical pro-life movement that then spawned people like James Dobson, Pat Robertson, all these guys that followed in my dad's footsteps, following his lead on this issue. And then they took it wider, of course, through radio and TV and all the media that they used to bring their message to a much, much bigger audience than he did. But he was really the daddy of this whole thing when it came to both the pro-life movement and also trying to bring Christ, as it were, into American politics, which eventually resulted in the religious right essentially taking over the Republican Party, which is what I talk about in both Crazy for God and also my book Patience with God, this new book of mine. And, you know, I guess what I saw happening and why I eventually got out dad died in 84. By 85, I had kind of gotten out of the evangelical movement, and but was still voting Republican for a few years. And then in 2000, having become utterly disgusted with the whole movement, jumped out, as you say, based on just how McCain was being lied about by the Bush people. And then, of course, as soon as I was out, began to really see things differently, and my politics shifted. In the last couple of years, I've been blogging for Alternet and HuffPost and other people, mainly in support of Barack Obama's candidacy and then presidency. So I'm someone who kind of saw a trajectory which could be almost, as I describe it in Patience with God, a kind of metaphor for the whole movement that I was part of, starting out kind of sincerely, capitalizing on power connections, capitalizing on the money revenue from the movement, and eventually, for me personally, becoming totally disillusioned with this power grab that the evangelicals made through the religious right and then the Republican Party, to where today I look at it as an extraordinarily dangerous movement, and I'm a very apologetic for the part I played in it as a younger man, and glad that I was able to get out while I still had some life left to talk about it.
Now, Frank, help me understand the path here, because I do respect people who disagree with me on abortion rights, and I do understand people who have a purist or ideal view that every life is sacred and
right.
that life begins at conception. I don't agree with that, but that's an understandable position for people to take.
Sure.
But what I haven't understood is how those leaders found comfort in aligning with low-tax, small-government, militaristic Republican politics. And in particular,
right.
over the last 8 years, we have not heard nary a peep from religious right leaders about the massive shift in wealth in this country. Jesus
yeah.
wouldn't have approved of that.
Right.
The incredible militarization that we've undertaken and this preemptive philosophy that was articulated by Bush, that we can attack anybody anywhere if we think they might want to come after us,
right.
and plunging into an illegal war on false pretenses in Iraq. This ongoing struggle in Afghanistan that
yeah.
I think more people are getting clarity on. You get my point. What
yeah.
happened to
well,
people
I
who
mean,
had a
you
strong
know, take,
they had a strong moral base and message,
yeah.
and it's been corrupted by their attempt to bring it to fruition politically?
Yeah, I mean, just to sort of take your analogy a step further or make an analogy here. I mean, here you have a group of people who claim to be following Christ, who are fighting against health care for children but pushing torture as a legal means of combating our enemies. So speaking of a reversal, an absolute reversal, you know, there was something that happened a little while ago, 4 years ago, to a friend of mine, Richard Cizik, who at that time was vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals,
mm-hmm.
a very big group. And James Dobson, who's this ultra-right-wing power broker with his focus on the family media empire, wrote a letter to the board demanding that Rich Cizik be fired for the crime of saying global warming was a real threat.
Right.
And in the letter he said, well, he should be fired because that's not going to help President Bush. And, you know, if you really just want to stand back and say, you know, this started as a religious crusade and wound up, first of all, taking over the Republican Party, then utterly corrupting it, and then in turn the religion itself being utterly corrupted by this access to power, where the folks, even the ones who were sincere at the beginning, let alone the flakes who jumped in for the money or the access to power, completely forgot where they came from. And so today, you know, you have an absolutely morally bankrupt Republican Party trafficking in the kind of lies Sarah Palin's been telling about death panels and so forth, and you have an absolutely morally bankrupt far-right religious groups in America who essentially have traded any kind of prophetic witness they might have for keeping George Bush in the White House for 8 years, believing his lies about Iraq being a harbinger of weapons of mass destruction or that they had something to do with 9/11, and supporting torture, invasion of civil liberties, and all the rest of it. So you're absolutely right. And the reason it happened is very simple, and that is that there are three kinds of people who are in evangelical leadership today. There's the group that started out, as I did in the 70s before I got out, who were sincere enough in their beliefs, whether you agree or not with what those beliefs were, and then were corrupted by access to power and access to money, and in a sense lost faith, but did embrace the adrenaline rush of being able to sit down with vice presidential candidates or get their call taken at the White House, whatever it might be. Then there are the absolute flakes who were basically, from the very beginning, simply capitalizing on what they saw as an opportunity to raise vast amounts of money and be players. And then there's the cynics who long ago lost all faith, but who are still in the game because they like schmoozing with powerful people, and now, you know, they feel somehow that Barack Obama is their sworn enemy, partly because of racial things, partly because they see white people losing control of this country, partly because they disagree philosophically, or at least they feel that his views on things like medical reform and all the rest of it run counter to what they believe in. But the real game is not their Christianity. It's simply power and Washington, D.C. And so you look across the board, and it's hard to say who suffered most. The Republican Party's in ruins, marked by the fact that McCain, who used to be an honorable guy, whether you agreed or disagreed, fell so low that he had to go back to those agents of intolerance, as he called them, and nominate one of them in Sarah Palin just to throw red meat to the far right and the religious right. And the religious right itself is in absolute ruin as one scandal after another overtakes it, be it the senators and congressmen who come out of C Street or the family that my friend Jeff Charlotte's written about, who you know are committing adultery left, right, and center, running off to South America to have affairs. And these are the guys who are talking about family values. So any way you slice this.
Well, the family values are that, you know, Senator Ensign's family, his parents paid off the mistress.
Right. And any way you look at it, it's a disaster. So, you know, to sort of come full circle, I mean, if you look at the writing I've been doing, whether it's the blogs, or whether it is in this book, Patience with God, what I'm trying to do is two things. First of all, make some amends, set the record straight. But secondly, I would like to change the conversation and just say, look, been there, done that. This way lies madness. Glenn Beck, Fox News, these guys stirring up potential violence against our president. If you take what they're saying literally, that's where it's going to go.
And somebody does take that stuff literally. We know that.
Well, we saw it happen in Pittsburgh when three police officers were shot down by a man who believed that now Obama was president, the police were going to take away his guns.
Mm-hmm.
And where did he get that stuff? He got it off the drumbeat from Fox News, Rush Limbaough, and all the rest of this media that have been
Tiller,
these nonsense.
Tiller the
lies.
Baby killer.
There's going to be more of that.
And Tiller the baby killer was
Tiller
something
the baby
that
killer, then he
triggered.
Shot down. And,
yeah.
And, of course, you know, Obama is Hitler. Obama is Stalin. Obama is a communist. Obama is the Antichrist. People look at these statements, and if you're not in that movement as I was, you don't take them seriously because they're so absurd. But the fact is, as long as there's one nutcase out there with a gun in his basement and a couple of boxes of ammunition who takes it seriously, we could all be in trouble.
Well, Frank, it was just a little over a year ago that I was there at the stadium in Denver as Obama was delivering his acceptance speech for the Democratic Convention.
Right.
And it was impossible. I was up in a skybox looking down at this massive crowd, and certainly security was very high, and I understood all that, but
right.
I just could not shake away the premonition that somebody is going to go for this guy. And we don't like to give voice to it because that tends to encourage nutcases to try to fulfill an ugly prophecy. But we can't be silent about this. The Department of Homeland Security has published a report which identifies white evangelicals with guns as a high-risk category for fomenting violence in this country. That's denounced as, you know, a secular attack on Christians.
Right.
But the facts are there. And
well, the fact is, you look at the Boston Globe article last week that just simply stated the bare fact that the Secret Service is now so overstrained by the multiplicity of threats against the president, more than any other presidency that the modern-day Secret Service has had to deal with, that their budget is so stretched that they don't know if they can carry on their multiple activities of, for instance, chasing down counterfeiters and stuff because their hands are so completely full with an overburdened security system. And this comes from somewhere. It doesn't come from a vacuum. And then when you look at this trajectory, you know, the thing that is threatening about the situation is, look, in the 1930s, for instance, there was Father Coughlin, who was a nutcase like a Glenn Beck of that day, calling, you know, our president Roosevelt at that point a communist or a conspirator with the Jewish conspiracy, whatever. And this guy Coughlin wound up sympathizing with the fascists and all the rest of it. But here's the difference. he didn't have a vast network of religious organizations that have been in the business of fomenting civil disobedience and protests since the 1970s. In our case, that would have put it since, say, 1910 in his day. Nor was there a Rupert Murdoch putting billions of dollars, literally billions of dollars, behind a right-wing media empire to amplify what otherwise would simply be, you know, a lunatic on a street corner on a dark night barking at the moon. And instead of that, this guy is given the nation's biggest megaphone. And, of course, the law of averages mean that you're just playing Russian roulette with who his listeners are. He may or may not take the stuff he's saying seriously enough, but it's gone to the point now where it's genuinely, I believe, fomenting not just violence, but bordering on, as I've put it in the piece I wrote, trawling for assassins. And that's where I think we're at. And I think when you combine the history of the religious right movement in the last 30 years in this country, and you see, for instance, this summer where they're in town meetings screaming down people who are for health care reform, what were they yelling? Well, they were yelling about death panels, and they were yelling about the Nazis, and they were yelling all this stuff. Well, guess who invented all that? It was the people like me and my dad and Dr. Koop in the 70s and 80s. This was the language we used to try to scare people into our movement and get them to agree with us on our views on abortion.
And Frank, let me lead
to euthanasia and infanticide and all this stuff that never actually happened. People like Dick Armey in the healthcare industry have picked that lingo up, and now they have recycled it as the bedrock of their debate against healthcare reform. And of course, they're running around calling Obama a Nazi or that he's going to be like Hitler. Well, what sort of a... This isn't even a coded message anymore.
Now, Frank, let me stop for a second here because you just touched on a couple of important things here. Dick Armey and his operation called FreedomWorks,
right,
aligned with Americans for Prosperity. They've got the pipeline to Glenn Beck. They've got the money from big oil and the tobacco industry and pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
And they are creating these phony grassroots movements. And they had a website up earlier this year called Recess Rally, which gave pointers to people on how to disrupt a town hall meeting about health care.
Right.
And so we see this very unhealthy collaboration between the big money interests who freely use evangelicals. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten from the Christian Coalition against any kind of health care reform that's being discussed in Washington right now. And so my question is, I'll frame it around Tom Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah.
At what point do people realize that they are being ruthlessly and cynically used, that their religion is being used to manipulate them and control them and induce them to do things that are unchristian, to say the very least? And at what point do they wake up and say, Sarah Palin doesn't speak with me, she's a bozo?
Right. Yeah, well, you know, in some senses it's already happening, in that if you look at the polling statistics taken on exit polls in the last election, about 20% of even people who identified themselves as evangelicals under the age of 30 were voting for Obama. So there is a shift already generationally. The problem is this. There's two things going on here. There's the Rupert Murdoch-type corporate approach that's in bed with the insurance industry via Dick Armey and all these other guys, and that's very plain as the nose on our faces to see. There's a subtext here, though, and that is we have an apocalyptic worshiping cult in this country that actually looks forward to Armageddon. They don't want solutions. They would like to see everything go down in chaos. So when they hear that 40 million Americans are uninsured or their own insurance may be canceled or that the world likes us better because Obama gets a standing ovation in Cairo University, you know, they look at that as him making our country not only weaker, but that they're disappointed. Oh, shucks, now the apocalypse moves away a few days here. You know, much better, bring it on. You know, they're sort of George Bush was their guy. Bring it on. Let's just fight more wars. Build more bombs. Let's go get everybody. Let's have a showdown here. Why? Because in this apocalyptic cult of evangelical Christianity, looking forward to Armageddon and the end times, the more chaos there is, the better, because it brings war in the Middle East. It brings economic destruction at home. It brings the famines that the Bible prophesies in and the plagues coming that you see in these sort of biblical prophecies of the book of Revelation. They love all this stuff. In fact, I've got a whole section in Patience with God just examining the kind of evangelical inferiority complex that comes of thinking that they've been shut out of the process, which is ironic given they've been running the country for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
And how this has led to this weird fascination with the end times, provable by the millions of sales of these end time novels, the Left Behind series, 16 books now, video games, wallpaper,
yeah,
children's lights. I mean, you name it. It's an empire, and what it really is a kind of a cultic fascination with the end of humanity by a group of people who aren't interested in facts anymore. They don't care if health care will be better for the country. They're way beyond that. They're living in the planet of, you know, Jesus will come back. You know, they're waiting for spaceship Jesus, and the rest of us are all just mired in these worldly concerns, like, say, feeding hungry people or stopping wars or getting health care. Meanwhile, they're rooting for the apocalypse. So when you mix that stuff that I cover in my book into the mixture here, it's really noxious, because you have the corporate interests on one end that are doing this just for the buck, and then you have this lunatic fringe, huge group of evangelical Christians and fundamentalists who literally believe that we're on the cusp of the return of Christ, so reforming our healthcare system doesn't matter at all anyway, and what we should be rooting for is just war, 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 and more war, because that leads to Armageddon and then Jesus comes.
And Frank, in the interview you gave to Larissa Alexandrovna, you dropped a very powerful line that I'd like to quote. Christian Zionists love Israel the way oncologists love cancer. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, on the surface, guys like Reverend John Hagee in Houston, who embraced John McCain until John McCain found out what Hagee was about and backed off as if he had just been bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at what Hagee's teaching is, he's one of these people who loves the whole end-time eschatology business. He's totally into that. He's looking for the signs of the end time. But he'll sit down with rabbis and people from the far right of the Zionist movement and say, hey, we can make common cause. I love Israel. Let's be pro-Jewish. Let's do this. Let's do that. But if you peel back the layer, that kind of pro-Israeli stance has nothing to do with wanting the well-being of the state of Israel. Israel, to these folks, is just a pawn in the end times game. In other words, you know, they look at Israel the way the Germans look at Poland in 1939. It's just a road to the Soviet Union. They don't care about Poland. They're moving east. Well, similarly, Israel to the Christian Zionist movement, they could care less, because in their eschatological unfolding of the Book of Revelation, they think only a handful of Jews are even going to survive Armageddon, and that it's all just the good Christians that are going to heaven. The Jews are going to burn now and later, but in the meantime, they're useful to them. And of course, you know, from a secular Jewish point of view, or even a traditional Orthodox Jewish point of view, one could say, well, so what? They're on the side of Israel. What do we care what their motives are? But the fact of the matter is, these people have tremendous antipathy toward any peace process. One reason they hate Obama is he's reaching out to the Islamic world saying, well, maybe we don't all have to kill each other. Maybe there's a better way. And they hate the idea that might work, because what they want to do is basically have the United States be one of the sticks, as it were, that beats the process of peace and reconciliation to death again and again and again, so that Armageddon can be fulfilled, the Jewish state can expand into greater Israel, that'll bring it on, as it were, from all these places that they're foretelling will attack them, whether it's Iran or the Russians or the Chinese, because they keep filling in different blanks here. They keep changing their story. But the underlying message is the same, and that is, to them, Israel's just a means to an end, which is why I say they love Israel the way oncologists love cancer. Sure, on the surface, you hold the cancer patient's hand. I'm on your side. You're fighting a great fight. Let me talk to your family. Let me help you. But he goes home at the end of the day and plays golf and knows that his membership at his country club is paid for precisely because there are people out there with cancer. So it's a very weird kind of love of Israel.
And I'm a frequent critic of the state of Israel for its brutal occupation of Gaza, and most recently, the assault that began on our election day last year, ran through the Christmas holidays, and then
right,
was suspended just before Obama was inaugurated. And you probably know the numbers. It was 1,400 Palestinians who were killed and 14 Israelis.
Right, exactly.
And just and, on the face of it, that disproportionality, given the power that Israel has over the Palestinians, is unconscionable and immoral.
And yet that is rationalized
along the Bush model, that this was preemptive defense, as they
right,
just slaughtered women and children, and you know, certainly did kill many Palestinian fighters as well.
Yeah, and the problem is, you see, there's no end to that path. And the good thing about the Obama presidency, both in the race, but also now to the extent he's able to, imperfect as it may be, because of all the compromises he has to make with just simply this great ship of state he's slowly trying to turn, is that if the only thing we can offer the world is nature, is naked power and hitting back and all these preemptive strikes, obviously in the long run, even demographically speaking, not just Israel, but the West in total will lose, because the world is not, you know, the majority of the world population is not white, Anglo-Saxon, American, right-wing, Republican, born-again Christians. It's a diverse globe, many religions, many faiths or no faith at all, as is our own country now. And, of course, that's what they can't come to terms with. This is why they're all in a tremendous panic, because their mythical overlay that they kind of sort of place over the map of the world, where Europe and the United States is the center of everything, and then the U.S. is really the center, and then in the center of the center are the, quote, real Americans, not, you know, East Coast, West Coast, or people in universities, but small-town USA, and then, of course, within small-town USA, only the good guys who vote Republican, and then within that group, only the good guys who vote Republican and are born-again right-wing Christians. And so it's a real little small circle. And, of course, so they identify very strongly with what you might call the radical right-wing elements of Zionism, which have sort of been running the whole show in Israel for a while now. But the sad thing is, for someone like me who roots for the state of Israel on many fronts, I see that very much as not just a kind of an apocalyptic death wish, but maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because if you keep doing these things in violent apocalyptic terms, and nobody really wants to make peace, and they keep building settlements, and no one will talk, and they're egged on by this evangelical groups in America that are even more hardline than they are, then there's no end in sight. And I don't think in the end there's any hope even for the state of Israel or anybody else for that matter. We're just going to be in you know, a 100-year cycle of war.
Now, Frank, what you described a moment ago is kind of a microcosm that reminded me of the family, this low-key but very influential religious fraternity with the house on C Street in Washington. And they really, as revealed through the Sanford case, I think show that they care much more about power than they do about individuals or about a Christian message, and that it really seems that they are so cynical that religiosity and the message of Christ are just tools that they use to propel and extend their own personal power.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, Jeff Charlotte, who wrote The Family, is someone I know quite well, actually. On November 5, for any of your listeners in the New York area, Jeff and I are going to be at a reading for my new book, Patience with God, where his group is going to be there, and we're going to be talking about that, and I can tell you where that is. But, you know, when you look at what he wrote in The Family and the group as it is, and Doug Coe and these guys, some of whom I've known in the past, long time ago, again, it's one of these things that if you just peel back all the layers, it's really not about religion. It's about access to power, and religion becomes a means, not an end. And these guys are shamefacedly power-chasing. In other words, they've actually developed a theology of dominion where the rich guys and the wealthy guys, sort of the reverse of Christ's message, are going to inherit the earth, and somehow Jesus got it wrong when he said the meek would inherit the earth or do unto the least of these, and what they're all about is the most of these. So, you know, these places, these national prayer breakfasts they run, and C Street in Washington, it's all about catering to what they regard as the American power elite, and bypassing, as it were, the whole democratic system and simply going, rather than arguing your case on facts or trying to convince people, you just go to the decision maker, bypass all the little guys like you and me and others down the road and cut straight to the chase, influence power at the top and kind of have Caesar's ear. So it's about as far away from anything that might be looked at as traditional Christianity or even religion as you can get, but nevertheless fits very much with this kind of evangelical idea that somehow this was founded as a Christian country and we got to use all means to get it back to that, and or if you're of a slightly different branch of this faith, egg on the apocalypse and forget about you know, a happy ending here, just power all the way, support Israel, and let's all head for Armageddon and get it over with. And either way you slice these two halves of the movement, it leaves the rest of us and the rest of the country very, very short, and essentially is so far anti-American, albeit sometimes wrapped in the flag, that it makes the new left of the 60s and 70s, you know, look like right-wing John Birch Society founders by comparison. I mean, it is the right wing in America now that, ironically, with all the flag-waving, is profoundly anti-American. I mean, even in the case of Sarah Palin's husband and her own lecturing to the Secessionist Party of Alaska or the Secessionist Party in Texas that Beck has been boosting, these guys don't even want the union to hold together. They're literally working for the dissolution of the union in some cases. So I think a lot of folks just don't have a handle on how anti-American the right wing in this country has become.
Well, and how anti-Christian, in your interview with Larissa at Raw Story, and we're not on radio, we're on a podcast here, so we can say these things without getting a $350,000 fine.
Right.
But it's really important for people to understand that you have been the target of many people who describe themselves as devout Christians and who consider you to be a traitor.
Right.
And one group of them is called Church Ladies. And they sent you a bunch of emails, and I'll quote from them.
Yeah.
Mr. Schaefer, don't let the door hit your ass on the way out, you fuck. Good fucking riddance, you fucking crybaby. And there are others. We don't need your lame-ass motherfucking comments or your support. Now, a lot of people can hide behind email, and you don't necessarily have to
right.
be a devout person to call yourself a church lady on the Internet. But these are typical of the kind of two-facedness where they can be pious and, express their devotion to religious principles at the same time that they attack you in a scatological way that
right.
is clearly unchristian.
Yeah, but the thing is, see, this is where if you're convinced you're right, and if you're convinced that you absolutely have the totality of truth and a handle on the future and prophecy and you name it, then, anybody who disagrees with you is not just wrong, but they're of the devil. They're wrong. They're going to be damned for eternity for being wrong. It's not, the vengeance doesn't stop with an email. These guys are sure that I'm going to hell and burn, and maybe you are too. In fact, anybody not like them is doomed for eternity. So this ratchets up the level of self-righteousness to almost infinity. And, of course, anybody who's been in that world as I have and who leaves it and then writes books like Crazy for God or Patience with God, which I've written, and In Patience with God dissects, what happens when you have a couple million people running around waiting for the end and rooting for it, which I do in the book, then the blowback can be, severe, intense, and rude, and also very stupid at times. But, of course, that doesn't make it any less dangerous. And if you think that's the kind of thing I get for going on Rachel Maddow or writing a blog or two or a book or two, you can only imagine why it is that the Secret Service is somewhat perplexed
mm-hmm.
by how they're going to stretch their budget to protect our first black president, who also happens to be a progressive, who, by the way, also happens to be a believing Christian, which you'd never know listening to these folks who call him the Antichrist, and who, to the best of his ability, is trying to steer this country in a more compassionate and humane direction. You wouldn't know any of that listening to the kind of nonsense that's talked about when it comes to the president, and you can just imagine. I mean, imagine what they're sifting through on the White House email line and also the phone lines and the rest of it.
And Frank, as we referenced earlier, you are supporting an effort called StopDomesticTerror.com. That's a
right.
website that has been put up by VelvetRevolution.us. And they're a good group. I've supported their efforts in the past to clean up our electoral process. They also have an effort to expose the work of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which I think is a very important project. But tell us what you think we need to do to make people aware of this risk, and how do we get to the nutballs who watch Glenn Beck, who take him literally, who believe in their Second Amendment rights, who believe in that the end times are here, and so they are as dangerous as the most radical Islamic jihadist, who we like to use as poster boys
right.
to say that that's what pure evil is on this earth.
Yeah, and they are just as dangerous. And weirdly enough, the BBC had a great analysis program last week on comparing the part of Shia Islam in Iran with Ahmadinejad as one of their folks that believes this, that their hidden prophet, which is sort of their equivalent of our returning Jesus, won't come back until there's absolute social chaos, and that rooting it on is a good thing. And, of course, we say, oh, yeah, those terrible people in Iran. Well, we got it right here at home in spades. exactly the same theology, just change the names a little bit. So, you know, we have a real problem. I think what we can do is several things. First of all, on a practical note, we go to the website that you just talked about, and we'll talk about again in a minute, and just sign on so that swells the number. Second thing we do is we let the Justice Department know that we expect them to do their job and to not give a free pass to people just because they call themselves Christian any more than they would to some Islamic charity that was funneling money to Hamas. And if we've come down hard on people like that, we ought to be coming down very hard on people in this country in terms of investigating and seeing what they're up to, either the extreme wings of the anti-abortion movement or others who produced the tillers of this, the folk that gunned down people like Tiller of this world. And often these guys are not being kept having an eye kept on them in the way that, for instance, the FBI looks at what they consider to be foreign nationals who might commit terror on U.S. shores. But I think the biggest thing we can do is this, if there was one thing, and that is I think that the folks who run Fox News, whether it's Rupert Murdoch himself or the executives like Ailes and other people, really need to be put in the hot seat. And we need to not be reticent to make a discussion in the mainstream media loud and clear, starting with blogs, people talking, and the rest, saying, look, we are going to hold you guys accountable. And that is, if Rupert Murdoch wants to be remembered as the person who went out trawling for assassins until he found one, or somebody who would commit the next Oklahoma bombing, we're not going to forget who put our lunatic fringe, our idiot village idiots, up to this. When it comes to the village idiots themselves, I have bad news for everybody. And that is that the really convinced hardcore of the religious right is never going to change their mind. There are no arguments that can change their mind because they resist facts from the ground up. These are folks who think the earth is 6,000 years old, that everything that happens in history is part of the end time, moving towards Jesus' return, probably in our lifetime. They love the idea of war in the Middle East. They hate the United States of America. They're the backdrop of people like the secessionist parties and others that want to break off and form little enclaves of white American heavily armed Christians in the woods somewhere. Well, you know, more power to them. But what we should do is at least say that when someone like Murdoch gives these folks voice through a slightly more respectable form of, say, Glenn Beck, who plays footsie with these people and encourages them with all his lying, but also just his innuendo about understanding secessionists and being sympathetic and all the rest of it, that people like Murdoch and his corporation and his good name in society should again and again and again be held up for what it is, and that is incitement to violence. And we need to not back away, and we need to stop being polite about this. The people who are making hundreds of millions of dollars off spreading this stuff need to be told that we know who they are, we being ordinary American people. And we're going to hold them accountable, and we're going to keep reminding our Justice Department, our State Department, the FCC, and anybody else who will listen that we're sick and tired of it.
Well, I certainly agree with you. There are some paradoxes here, that the more we try to put rational constraints on people like Glenn Beck and the other yahoos at the Fox News channel, it makes them more attractive to unstable individuals. It draws attention to them, to people who, for one reason or another, hadn't been paying attention to them up to that point.
Right.
So I think that, to me, the effort that was undertaken by the group Something of Color, Change of Color, that used to be aligned with Van Jones, they led the effort to boycott advertisers of the
right.
Glenn Beck program. And it did produce the attacks on Van Jones and, I believe, his departure from the White House, at least in part.
Right.
But I think that we do need to take these issues on in a sensible way.
Right.
And we need to try to turn down the heat.
Exactly.
While still firmly rejecting the kind of hooliganism and vigilantism that is being used as techniques by these fairly powerful communicators.
Yeah, but I think, I think that when I talk about going after Murdoch and so forth, I think this is where perhaps the White House tactic could misfire a little bit. I'm not talking about answering lie for lie with these guys. I'm talking about cutting to the chase and just saying, look, this is not a game, Mr. Murdoch. You know, this is our history you're gambling, but this is a country that a few years ago was lynching people because they were black. This is a country that has a well-armed militia groups all over it. This is a country that has a history of domestic terrorism. We've had our own Taliban here for centuries in various forms. Stop fooling with this and do it on the highest level. And literally, from the White House, you know, what Glenn Beck does doesn't matter. What Fox News does doesn't matter. What matters is that there are a couple of billionaire media moguls out there who are giving an amplified microphone to these folks, and instead of talking about the actual content, we ought to simply be talking about the business arrangements and who's profiting from not just spreading lies, but fomenting what is going to turn out to be violence in this country. And that ought to be attached to it, to the point where somebody like Rupert Murdoch should not be able to appear in public without having to answer a lot of very difficult questions. So rather than taking issue with his foot soldiers and his peons and his basically unimportant commentators like Glenn Beck, who are all interchangeable with each other, we should be talking about the corporate structure in the same way that the real story is not Dick Armey and the teabaggers and all this. The real story is the corporate lobbyists who are trying to derail health care so that they can all make $100 million a year each. That's what we really should be talking about. And mm-hmm. So I think we need to look at who profits and who is gambling with our future, whether it is the health insurance industry gambling with the health of our country literally for profit, or whether it's Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, and these other people who are making hundreds of millions of dollars personally off essentially feeding red meat that they themselves do not believe in for one second, because yeah. They're not stupid. They're not idiots themselves. They don't. There's nothing they believe in here except generally an antipathy toward our government because they don't like any regulation that gets in the way of their business. But other than that, they have absolutely no principles at all. But they are gambling with yours and my future. And we elected this president, and we want him to do a job for us. And I think that people like Murdoch have to be put on notice, and it has to be brought up on every level, whether it's letters or emails, whether it's articles, whether it's simple conversation, whether it's programs like this, that you know, we're going to follow the corporate money back to the source, and we're going to make those people understand that they can't have it both ways. They can't have profit and respect in the community and at the same time deal in this kind of stuff.
Visit the website stopdomesticterror.com, and you can get more information. Frank, what are the details on your event with Jeff Charlotte in New York on November the 5th?
It's not a big deal, but it's Thursday, November 5th. It's at 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's a reading and a discussion at the Lolita Bar at 266 Broom Street in New York, and you can find that on my website, his website, or just on Facebook, whatever. But it's 6 to 9 and Lolita Bar, 266 Broom Street in New York on November 5th, which is next Thursday, I believe.
Frank's new book is Patience with God, Faith for People Who Don't Like Religion or Atheism. Frank Schaefer, thank you for speaking up.
Hey, my pleasure, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.